First thing as we normally do, we'll set our motivation, generate the mind of enlightenment, say the prayers that follow on, and then we can engage in the actual lesson. So please just get comfortable in your seat. Ideally, your back is straight, your shoulders are relaxed, your head is sitting evenly upon your neck, your hands are in a comfortable position. Your eyes could be completely closed, partially closed or fully open, whatever suits you. So you're comfortable sitting in your seat, and the body is breathing itself normally and naturally. And the space above you, just in front of you, appears a golden throne, and on that throne sits Shakyamuni Buddha, his body made of golden light. He is surrounded by your spiritual mentors, teachers of the lineage, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, meditational deities, arahats and protectors. While you yourself are surrounded by all living beings. So your mother beside you on the left, your father beside you on the right, friends and family behind you, difficult people in front of you, and strangers surrounding them all. You recollect that we equally, all of us, wish to avoid suffering, equally have a wish to be happy, but equally lack genuine happiness. Now, the causes that prevent genuine happiness can be eliminated. And the potential for genuine happiness abides equally within all of us. And to dispel the causes of suffering and to actualize a genuine happiness, we have to have a method and be convinced that it's actually possible. So the possibility of being genuinely happy is being realized by the Buddha. He realized that through his teachings called the Dhamma. And ever since then, there's been a spiritual community practicing the teachings. So I think that if you want to really develop your wisdom and your compassion and your skills to abandon suffering and its causes and help others do the same, you can rely upon the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So this sort of feel that you are in the presence of enlightened beings and you are surrounded by all sentient beings. You wish to lead all these sentient beings into a state of freedom. And so you say, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. In response to this prayer of ours, I think that lights and nectar stream forth from the heart of each enlightened being above you. These lights and nectars rain down upon you and all beings surrounding you. Or wash away every hindrance and obstacle to your spiritual progress. And revealing the innate Buddha nature present within you. You recollect the four immeasurable thoughts of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. You decide to develop these yourself and to establish all beings in those four states. So affirming this, you say, May all sentient beings have happiness from its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Again, like some nectar stream forth from the heart of each enlightened being above you. They wash over you and all the beings surrounding you. We remove every hindrance and obstacle to the generation of these four immeasurable thoughts and reveal that these four qualities of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity are effortlessly manifesting. And they recollect the field of merit and faith and devotion. Prepare yourself to purify the mind, accumulate merit, and then to increase that merit. And so you say, reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions, accumulated since the beginning of this time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma from within the beings. I dedicate my own and other spirits to the great enlightenment. Now, to prevent ourselves from clinging to the practices we've done so far to be truly existent, recollect the wisdom of emptiness, whereby all things exist dependently. So here, depend upon your own wisdom. Reimagine your body, speech, and mind, your merits you've created, and the universe itself to be a pure land which you want to offer to the field of merit. So you say, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, the dawn of Mount Meru, full of confidence, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a good field of offering. May all living beings who live this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamaya Tayam. So the Buddha accepts you often and smiles at you, and you look up and meet his gaze. You feel as if he's actually heard your requests, he understands your needs, and you feel accepted and at ease. The emanation of the Buddha leaves his heart, it moves through space and comes to abide above the crown of your head, facing in the same direction you are. Now this emanation starts to descend, coming down through your head, down through your throat, into your body, and down to the level of your heart. And reaching the level of the heart, the emanation begins to expand, filling your body and mind with lights and nectars. And these pour out through the pores of the skin, filling the 10 directions of space and establishing every being within space to now be within the enlightened state. And pervading all of space, you hear and recognize the mantra of the Buddha, and you join in reciting it three times along with me. Tarata Om Muni Muni Mahamunaya Soha. Tarata Om Muni Muni Mahamunaya Soha. Tarata Mahalaya Soha. Now in the breath, we started a few more times. Taha Having 10 directions of space, the light rays return, re-entering your heart. You can feel the movements of your breath in your belly, in your upper chest, in your shoulders. You feel embodied once again. You understand that this meditation is one of imagination. Nevertheless, it has imprinted the mind. So that your potential to become an awakened ever closer. So you take a sense of joy in that, and you breathe in through your nostrils and exhale through your mouth. And in your own time, you let your eyes flutter open, you move your body, you bring yourself be present at your desk. Or oh, listen to it. Okay, so we look at what we've gone through so far. This has been our fifth, this is our class five. So we've looked at, first class, we looked at some Buddhist history and our teacher's lamp. Then we looked at the 12 deeds of a Buddha. We know there are hagiography and not a history. We looked at the three wrong ways of listening and there's five. Correct way of listening, six. Thank you, Ben. Six. And then we know there's this outline for the foundation of all good qualities that we're studying. And last week we finished up on teachings on persons of small capacity, those who wish to avoid taking the lower realm rebirth and want to receive a higher realm rebirth. For those classes in this one, I've relied upon these books here. These books. Commentaries have commentaries on them, on the foundation of all good qualities and the three principal aspects of the path. So today we're going to look at the practices for the person of middling capacity and also look at verses 5 and 6 of the foundation of all good qualities. This foundation of all good qualities is made up of 14 verses. The first two verses are called preliminaries. And the first verse of the preliminaries begins, the foundation of all good qualities is the kind and venerable guru. Who could complete this verse? Excellent. And then we have the second verse, which says that understanding the precious freedom of this rebirth is found only once. Oh, very good.
Well,
excellent. Very good. Okay. And then we looked at, we actually began the teachings for the beings with these three capacities. Like I said, last time we looked at the person with of small capacity. And in those verses there, they cover impermanence, death, the results of white and black karma, and sort of warns us against engaging in the 10 unskillful behaviors. Because if we do, we might find ourselves taking the unfortunate rebirth. And it's encouragement to engage in the 10 virtuous practices. So verse 3 begins by saying, this life is as impermanent as a water bubble. Finding firm and definite conviction in this. Yep, that's it. Fantastic. Good idea. Very good. Excellent. So I'll do this each week, right, each time we come up here. And so maybe next class we'll move on one or chuck you one. Well, if we don't know, just go, okay, so help me up then. and well. Yeah, so today we're going to be looking at these middling verses, 5 and 6. And you can see, I think there's 6 verses on the great scope. And then we finish off with a request and prayer. So we're going to be discussing the teachings for those of middling capacity. And these teachings are summed up by Lama Ratisha, who said in his Lamp for the Path, those who seek peace for themselves alone, turning away from worldly pleasures and avoiding destructive actions, are said to be of middling capacity. So this second level of spiritual maturity is people who have the wish to abandon cyclic existence altogether. This really involves realizing the entire system of our current existence is fundamentally unstable. It's just not right. There's something wrong about it. So the practitioner of middling capacity seeks total freedom by uprooting the mental distortions that cause suffering. Yeah, so these people were sort of a shift in perspective taking place. So yeah, instead of like the person of small capacity, who's really just sort of wanting better worldly experiences, this one is saying that, look, it doesn't work out that way. And it's not satisfying, so I want to move out of this. I want to exit this unsatisfactory way of being in the world. So his next slide sort of sums up what their aims are, what their practice is, what they're trying to eliminate. So here, like I said, their goal is liberation from cyclic existence. Sometimes this is called freedom or moksha, liberation, or even nirvana. These names just all mean the same thing, just different words. So to actually accomplish that, what they do is engage in the three higher trainings. And these three higher trainings are the higher trainings in ethics, higher trainings in concentration, and higher training in wisdom. And what these higher trainings do, they help eliminate the afflictive obscurations. So the afflictive obscurations is just another word you might call emotional afflictions. Things like afflictive doubt, anger, afflictive pride, all the sort of things that we already know that are distressing. So the goal is to get rid of those phenomena themselves, but also what causes them, which are what they call the seeds. Yeah? And you try to, again, because in response to the afflictions, we create actions, which are called karmas. And these karmas, if we meet up with them when we die, then we can be thrown back into the cycle of rebirth again and again and again. So we really try to get this and go, like, what causes uncontrollable rebirth and what can I do to stop it? That's what you're sort of asking yourself. And your answers to yourself will be the disturbing emotions call this. And you're looking at what causes the disturbing emotions. And you'll end up with ignorance of my reality. I'm wrong about who I am. I'm wrong about how the world exists. And that's the major cause of it. So the direct aim of this of a person in this capacity is to achieve what's called a peaceful liberation, a state of peace. They seek to end the cycle of involuntary rebirth by addressing the root of their problems, which of course is these polluted karma and the afflictions that drive them. Let's have a look, like I said, now we'll have a look at the, we have afflictive karma, but we also have what's driving it, which is called a delusion, or these afflictions. So we're going to look at what is a actual delusion, what is it? So it's defined as a mental factor that arises from inappropriate attention. And it functions to make the mind unpeaceful and uncontrolled. So in brief, an obscuring affliction is a mental event that sort of unsettles the mind the moment it arises. So when you look, some of these definitions are really interesting to sort of read and try and break them down. So there's this term here called inappropriate attention. And inappropriate attention has, could say, factors that are sort of easy to recognize, so they call it gross understanding, and factors that are more difficult to realize, it's called the subtle view of these inappropriate attention. So let's take an example, for instance, of the mind of anger, right? The affliction of anger. So how is its attention inappropriate? This what you sort of ask. Right? You just take an affliction and go, okay, if you're saying that all these afflictions come from inappropriate attention, what is that attention that is inappropriate? So if we take anger, inappropriate attention as it's related to anger, any ideas how that might help? You have to start, so the external objects are the actual cause of our anger. That'd be an inappropriate way of attending to the object. What else? The object itself has no good qualities. It's just out there to cause you harm. So if you notice this, whenever you get angry at somebody, right, you look at them, like, there's no way your mind is going, yeah, but they're a nice person. It just doesn't do that. Right? It only sees, it only apprehends what it doesn't like about them. You know, so it's inappropriate because nobody's like that, are they? You know, we have, there are times where, of course, we get angry, but half an hour later, we're nice again. You know, so obviously, you know, that's a wrong idea that the object is all bad. So it's all bad. The harm is coming from the side of the object. And there's another, here's the other one. So there's one other part is that, so why do you see it's all bad? You can't see the good. So it shuts out the good, only presents the bad, and then the bad seems to be coming from over there. So that is all mistaken. And so they call this type of attention, this is wrong, it's inappropriate to look at objects like that. So what would be a more appropriate way of looking at the object of, you know, we call the object of anger, would be... that's good, that's right. Yeah, so one part is you sort of come back to take ownership, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, no, this is a karmic appearance. It's like something is coming from my side. The bed,
I was just going to say just awareness of your own mind, of what's arising in your own mind.
Yeah, and so suppose, you know, the people are angry with us and they say what they're saying. So instead of getting responding with anger, which would be inappropriate, what you do is you look at this, this person is suffering. So anger is not an appropriate response to somebody who's suffering, right? Compassion is care is the appropriate response. So of course, you know, this takes a bit of time to study and do.
Practice.
We have to practice this. Right? So instead of, I mean, it's really difficult, isn't it? Because it looks like the behavior of the person are one and the same thing. It really does look like they're creating all my problems when they behave the way they are. And so we don't see them like through the lens of compassion, do we? You know, it's like, it just doesn't happen that way. They are actually just probably reading a book by Lama Zopa Rinpoche on patience. Man, that's a stunning book. But anyway, as it goes through, the whole thing is there's no, it's just, from this point of view, it's like anger is a completely wrong mind. It's just like, no, you can't, in fact, when you go through, you go, it serves no purpose.
A lot of the time, anger comes from hurt or a perceived hurt that someone has hurt you, and so you are angry at
No. The seed of anger is what you've caused, what you have done. You've caused somebody else you have it here.
But often it's the emotional experience firstly, and it's often so quick we don't even realize it, that we feel hurt and then respond in anger. So there's a perception that something has been done to us, or it's like almost a protective defense. I agree, it's all delusion and it's not the right mind and all the rest, but I just wanted to bring up the overlap of hurt and anger.
So in this particular commentary, so Rinpoche says that We are like walking sores with a great target on our back, right, to be hurt. Right, but why? Because we have hurt others.
Yeah.
And because we've hurt others, we have this thing on us to go, now hurt me. Right? And so others, they can't, others can't control themselves either. This thing is saying, hey, have a shot at me. And so they do. Right? So what they do, then they cause harm for themselves. And then we don't like it. And we go back at them to hurt them again. And so we go back in the loop again. We strengthen the target on our back.
It's also because we're attached to certain views of ourselves.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And when someone says something that attacks or
we perceive contradicts
our personal view,
yeah,
we get unhappy because we're attached to that.
And see, this is the other most subtle bit of inappropriate attention. That our inappropriate attention focused on our own sense of self. So we take ourself to be inherently existent where we're not, and so just follows the cause and effect of the skull.
I'm not sure about how Prophet's in that definition, but I heard of a man out of court and say delusions are distorting and disturbing.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like in terms of they distort our perception of reality.
Yeah, because they're all rooted in self-grasping ignorance, and self-grasping ignorance distorts the reality, so it appears inherently existent to you. Okay, so that's so what is appearing to your visual consciousness right now, right? We could say that's an appearance. Mm-hmm. So it's never pure, right? It's never just like that's it, it's nice and clean. Right? It's always filtered through your past. Through your past actions, behaviors, that's like that's the karma. And so, you know, and here's the appearance. So these two come together. As an example of that, yeah, you know, two people can look at, say, for instance, a pie in a shop window. Mm. And I go, and the other person, oh, disgusting. Right? So there's a karmic appearance type thing.
So it's not a different pie.
No, not at all. That's right. The pie, it's the perception of pie. Right?
But you bring this kind of perception
with yeah,
you.
Yeah, of course.
Or the non yeah. The you that is empty.
But yeah, yeah. Yeah, our consciousnesses aren't sort of like, you know, clean and nice and no, they're not at all. You know, so yeah. So the nature of these of a delusion is to be like unsettling. Its function is to destroy the tranquility of mind. And the meaning you take away, like it always creates difficulties and bad results for you. Now, independence upon these karmic appearances, we have some interesting things that take place. Oh man, I'm just saying this now, I'm just living some of the ridiculous things that I've believed recently. It's really shocking, to think that, you know, I heard somebody say this, something to me. And so I heard it, and I thought the meaning was in what they said. Right? And so I acted on it. And then it turned out later that they actually never meant at all what they said. Yes, the words were there, but it wasn't what they meant. Right? That's just another instance of a karmic appearance. Right? And I went along with it. And then found out later on, that never happened. That's not what they meant at all. I said, I didn't say that to you. Oh, that's not what I meant. I go, yes, you did. I had to stop a bit and go, oh, my God, this is what I've done. You know, someone must have done something like this. Somebody said something to you and you thought this is what they meant by it. And you went, you know, off. And then found later. Wasn't
your own connotations on what they were saying.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is what we do, isn't it? We try to make meaning in, you know, but that's the funny part, isn't it? You've got to remember, we're imputing the meaning onto what's heard. Maybe that's not the meaning.
So what would you suggest that we do instead? Because we need
to say, so I'm not sure I understand what you mean.
Right.
Yeah.
But if you don't realise, you think, oh, I
know, that's right. And because just like you're saying, it happens so quickly, you think you already know. And you don't question.
How do we get to
well, so what you need then is why the teachings are so important. Because the teachings that come from the Buddha, an enlightened being who went beyond the karmic appearances.
Right? If you're talking about verbal communication, I can remember going very many years ago to a communications skills course, and the first thing they said is, the problem with communication is we assume it occurs.
Oh, very good. Yeah, that's right. There's some ramificing assumption being the bedrock of this other. Like, oh my god, that's me. I assume I know what's going on, and I don't actually know. I think it'd have to depend here, Sandy, because you might have a bodhisattva on some high ground or something. They say something to you to go, well, that's not coming from suffering.
In our ordinary
lives. Sure, that's right. If you can assume you're meeting up with ordinary people and so forth, people just, like I say, really, that way you forgive your parents, they just did the best they could.
Yes.
It's like that, but underneath it all is they're not awakened beings, right? They're suffering, sentient beings doing the very best they can, and sometimes it's not too good. Yeah, we're doing the best we can, and we're suffering senior beings too. And like give that example of two souls rubbing up against each other. that describes the relationship of me and my parents. Two deluded lots of people rubbing up wrongly against each other and hurting each other. It's nice that it's nice that I can look back and see it and sort of appreciate what they're trying to do, doing the best they can under the circumstances. Yes. So anyway, from these karmic appearances and then the actions that follow, when we're not aware of this, of course, one of the worst things that can happen, of course, is war. And we've got a number of them going on around the world at the moment, and they've been going on ever since I've been born. This just keeps on going. But what I'm saying, I'd like to just look at what everybody says. We're just trying to bring peace through war. Well, good luck with that. It hasn't solved a thing since all throughout our lifetime, right? You get it just goes on and on. And so one of these things, like I say, ignorance of karma. So what it's sort of getting at is that if you do something rooted in a delusion, an affliction, the result's going to follow that. That's what the result will be similar to it. So in other words, look, you can't have a war here and think that everything's going to be good because of it. Right? And that's why people have them, isn't it? They're sort of saying, oh, no, we need security, or we need to do this and that. And you guys aren't doing that, so they're attacking to bring us to peace and harmony in the Middle East, for instance, right? You go, yeah, good luck with that. It has never happened. And again, so there's this misunderstanding of how cause and effect work. Well, we as the monks did. They took up rifles. I mean, initially Tashin's the only one was telling us, no? And they came in and all the monks were running up with rifles. It was like, and he didn't even know how to use them. I was just given here. Yes, they didn't want to protect them.
It is violence, but.
Sure is. And yet, you might want to defend. Yeah, so when you look at the these actions, it's important to always remember every action is made up of parts. So you can have a part that wishes to be aggressive and overcome and take away, but there might be the part that wishes to defend. So that's part of the action. And how the action finishes is with the death of somebody. So you can sort of look at it and go, I guess you don't get the same exact same result because of the intention behind the activity. One might be protect, and one might be to seek revenge or accumulate property or something like that. So, of course, these activities, so then we come to, how do we sort of decrease the effect of past unskillful karma. And this leads us into the opponents. So here on one side, we've got these effects, experiences like the cause. So where we, let's say, so like I said, the causes here might be to protect, or they might be to actually harm. Yeah, so one is protectors, one of harm, right? Yeah, these sort of things, right? So if you do not want to experience the effect that is like that cause, then remorse stops that. So in other words, like if you, you know, you carried out one of these activities, it was an unskillful karma, so we're not talking about defending or things like that. It's actually on the wrong side, the aggressive side. If you realize like what that will create for you in the future and you don't want to have that sort of experience, what stops it is remorse, because you won't do it again and it loses the power. And like this is the, there's two really important opponents here. This is the number one. If you don't have this one, the rest aren't going to work for you. And you only really have this, it's not looking so much at, when you do look at the cause, but what you're really looking at here is the effect later. Mm. Yeah, it's like you know, when you've grown up, at least my parents, I said, don't steal. You know, why not? You'll end up in jail. So it's like looking at this, you're looking at that, right? You're looking at this effect and go, well, you know, if you take things from others, you'll find your freedom taken away from you. That'll be your experience. Is that what you want? You're going to go, no. She's saying, don't take the things from others. There's this phenomenon called throwing karma. That's the sort of energy. You haven't sort of, the throwing karma brings about the fruitional effect, which would be the fourth one here. And that's how you stop that, is by finding a remedy. And as you, yesterday we talked about the six different types of remedy that you can engage in, like reading sutras, making satsas, reciting texts, interest in emptiness. There's lots of different things you can do here. Stops the throwing karma, takes away the energy of it. Now, the behavior is like the cause. So this one is like the one where we, if we take killing, for instance, so we go, what's the cause for killing? Well, there's basically three of them. You can take it, either one. One is ignorance. But the other could be attachment. The other is aversion. These are the three major ones. And so what happens, of course, that you do it again and again and again. And the way to stop that taking place is to resolve not to do it. So of all these opponents, remorse and resolve are the major ones. And if you took one, it would be remorse. You have to start there. You know, and so you look ahead at it and you say, well, this is going to be the effect. It's like, well, if I killed somebody today and I got away with it and got what I wanted, guess what? I might kill somebody tomorrow and do the same thing to keep on doing it. So what's going to stop you? The restraint, the resolve not to do it. And why not? Because you know that in the future, you're going to, you might get an experience like the cause, right? A sudden death, short life, all sickness, all sorts of things follow from these actions when we're born human. But in terms of the fruitional effect, so as a human being, you find yourself in a sort of, you might find yourself in the Middle East at the moment, or Angola, some place where there's wars going on, right? Or killing, a lot of killing is going on. So you find yourself in a place where that's taking place. What stops you doing that is your reliance upon the mind of enlightenment or your refuge. That stops that taking place. Okay, so it works like the same. So suppose we have potentials on our mind stream that could produce one of these effects. So this cause, which is a cause, it's got to come in, it's got to meet the right conditions for it to actually produce its effect. So when it meets the right conditions, then this cause is going to start producing its effect. That's the throwing karma.
Right.
Well, especially in terms of the fruition.
Yeah.
And yeah, that being the rebirth that way. Okay, so let's do a short meditation. Yeah, just take your posture, make yourself comfortable. So wiggle about until you're quite comfortable. Just elongate the spine, drop the shoulders, and check that your head is evenly balanced upon your neck. Then either partially close the eyes, close them completely, or leave them as they are. And feel your weight upon the seat. Let all the tensions just dissolve. I now set an altruistic intention to free yourself from cyclic existence for the benefit of all beings. Now consider how actions toward others are seeds planted in the ground of your future experience. Harming sentient beings destroys your peace, while ignoring this truth leads to painful rebirths. Violence is very much like mud thrown into a pond. It clouds the natural purity of the water of your mind. Now, what is the mental basis and attitude which define an action as a non-virtuous act of killing? So the mental basis means you require a living being. So the basis is a living being. The attitude driving the action is an intention driven by attachment or animosity or deep confusion. And this confusion is like a fever, which makes a person lash out, blind to their own sickness. So how does the experiential result manifest when you are born again as a human being? What do you experience when you've taken the lives of others and yet are born again as a human? Well, you find yourself experiencing sickness, a short life, and you experience the same fear that you once caused for others. But these experiences are they're merely clouds which obscure the clear sky of your fundamental radiant consciousness, which means that none of these experiences are intrinsic to the nature of mind. Now, why is the behavioral result of taking life dangerous for your character and evolution? Why is the behavioral result of taking life or killing dangerous for your character and spiritual evolution? while it leaves imprints upon the mind which compel you to repeat acts of violence. And this cycle can only be broken by adopting the preventative measure of restraint. Resolve will not do this again. So what can help us to abstain from violence, harmful actions? Well, if we could just pause before reacting. Know that happiness is never achieved through aggressive activities. So just pause, wait a few moments. Now breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through the nostrils. Okay, so now we come to the first verse of this foundation of good qualities. And so here it says, Dhamma Tsongkhapa says, seeking samsaric pleasures is the door to all suffering. They are uncertain and cannot be relied upon. Recognizing these shortcomings, please bless me to generate the strong wish for the bliss of liberation. Now, what I find quite interesting about these verses, if you go through different texts of commentary, you often find them written out quite differently. And so I've taken another one from a book written by a Lama called Geshe Wangyal, and he says this, which is quite interesting. The door to all misery is seeking satisfaction in pleasure. It's a little different, but like, you know, makes a difference. The door to all misery is seeking satisfaction in pleasure. Having realized that there is no security in the pernicious perfections of samsara, may I be strongly intent on the bliss of liberation.
What is pernicious,
mate? Well, I'll tell you shortly. So, the commentary says that though you seek happiness in samsara, you will never find satisfaction. It's like drinking salt water to satisfy thirst. Instead of being satisfied, your attachment will increase and become the door to great and long-lasting misery that far outweighs any happiness you might have found. He says, there is not the slightest security in worldly happiness. It's as momentary as a flash of lightning. And just as someone lost in the desert perceives the mirage, thinking it is water, in samsara, we pursue that which has a nature of suffering, thinking it is happiness. So, pernicious. Got a phone there? Get up. You'll see.
I like this verse because it relates to advertising in real life and how advertisers make us convinced that if we buy something, we'll be happy.
Yeah, that's, this is
we're not happy. And then we buy something more.
Yeah, yeah.
That's good. Like, and end up credit cards.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, so the people that know the greatest about this is just that the advertisers, the marketers, they've got this down pat, you know.
Yeah.
And even, I think Miffy was saying, you know, like how now they've got the algorithms, like especially for the poker machines too. That sort of thing. They're taking those algorithms and moving them across to other phenomena, and the same thing is happening. Like the phone, eh? People can't stop scrolling. Right? They've done got to be sort of careful about where you put your senses and how you engage with them. Otherwise, yeah, you just get swept away by this. Yeah, so there's a lot of like in this. I like the idea of the metaphor of drinking salt water to your first thought, oh man, I've done that over and over and over again. But and if you do that enough times, though, you realize, I'm not getting any happier here. It's not actually working. What I used to do, it's not working now. And Geshe, so Tsokhon Lhunpa says, before we were talking about trying to avoid all the problematic situations of being reborn in one of the worst states of rebirth. Now we expand our scope and think in terms of any kind of uncontrollably recurring situation in our compulsive samsaric existence. No matter how splendid they might seem, the various objects, positions, and pleasures that we have will never suffice. They only beget more problems and difficulties. Therefore, we try to develop the determination to be free from all problems and troubles completely. And this is what renunciation means. So this is a verse that's starting off on the middle scope there. Based on this determination to be free, we take an added interest in achieving a state of freedom. And this is the scope of motivation that's explained in this verse. This is the last line. Please, best to generate a strong wish for the bliss of liberation. So, Krishna Upasha, Krishna Tashi Sarah, remember him talking about this and saying, we know of the pleasures and the bliss we experience in samsara, right? We can drink, we can take drugs, we can have plenty of sex, we can do all sorts of things and mix them all up, right? Try and get more and better. But it doesn't work out. That's how it is, right? So he's sort of saying, we know about that type of bliss and pleasure, but we don't know about the bliss of liberation. We've never experienced it. So it's a very hard thing to move from what you do know into the unknown. Is it the only way to do that is to actually look at this and go, but is it pleasurable? Really? Is it, does it really have the promises appear to you? And you go, well, no. And so that's the thing, that's where you sort of go, okay, I might not know about this bliss of liberation they're talking about. Besides, what would it be? And the simple answer to that is an absence of disturbing emotions. That's what liberation is, right? When the mind is peaceful, why? Because it has no disturbing emotions. Like I said, so it's not it's not the objects that are the problem. It's how the mind is engaging with them. That's the problem. Like we think, if I do this or have that, I'll be happy. So you can see that's a mental thing, isn't it? And you said that's where you're fooling yourself. That's what you've got to stop doing. And you'll stop doing it by actually investigating, was it really that good? And you're going to go, no, it wasn't. In fact, it's really amazing that if you really pay attention, you won't find the happiness there at all. In fact, I remember students were asking an ordained person of how difficult it was to give up sex. Right? Now, I think they'd become ordained, and they knew they'd have to do that. So they asked them, what did you do? How'd you do it? So he gave a number of different ways you could do it, right? But what I liked, and it was a particular one I liked, was he said, look, yes, you can use all these techniques, but the one I prefer, and after the answer that I like too, is just pay attention. Just really pay attention when you're engaged in it. And just look for where is the pleasure? And of course, you might say, well, it's felt, but it's like, it doesn't last, as we all know. Yeah, so that's what's interesting. Let's pay attention. Just really, I thought of it later on. I thought, before paying attention, what's your mind doing when you don't pay attention? When you're just engaged, right? You don't even know, do you? I found what my mind is doing. It's not present there. It's imagining things. That's, you go.
And it's managing imagining a perfect scenario.
I also, well, that perfect. But yeah, we imagine scenarios. That's exactly us. We're not present.
That's true.
You know, like you get present, like it's very different. You'll try that next time, or you might decide, I don't think I want to be so present.
But there is present.
That goes, what do you find with the sensation?
Sorry?
What do you find with sensation?
Pleasure.
But then it's over.
Oh, I think, or maybe. Well, maybe. Yeah.
It depends on your expectations.
Well, this is the thing. The idea is not to bring expectation in. The idea is to look clearly. Like you bring expectation again. Again, this is like the karmic appearance stuff, isn't it? It's like, no, I just want to actually like experience as clearly as possible what is happening here. That's what you're sort of looking at, right? You try and do that in your, you know, just for me, I just go, wow, right. Wow, like, man, I used to make up a lot of stuff. So this renunciation, like, what is it? So it's often called the a wish to definitely emerge from the cycle of existence. A wish to definitely emerge from this uncontrolled recurring pattern. And how does it take place? You see the faults and the shortcomings. And go like, you know, you just get fed up with it. You know, well, that's it. I've had enough. Is that, you know, I used to think, is this as good as it gets? Is that it? And you might have to go, yeah, that's it. So the idea is to recognize the determination to be free as a joyful decision to seek lasting peace rather than temporary pleasure. Yeah, and so definite emergence is the term they often give it rather than the other call it renunciation. It's also called definite emergence. So it's the mental shift from chasing short-term fixes to seeking an exit from all sufferings. And this is the key to this, is we stay trapped because we mistake the causes of pain for the causes of happiness. That's the thing.
I'm
going to
keep doing it though.
The habit. Yeah, yeah.
So say you know all of this and you like, and then maybe you slip up or whatever. And is it just like continual practice that gets? So you just have to keep going, like keep trying.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. But that's what the in the patient's book today. At the last chapter, there's a thing that Shanti Davis, he says, like, everything becomes easier with familiarization.
Yeah,
yeah, with familiarity. It's true, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's, you know, and that's what it's saying. So, yeah, you just keep trying to get it. Like if you know that it don't work, you just have to keep trying. Don't you just go like, I'll go forward or slip back, but I know this doesn't work.
Yeah.
I need to keep trying.
It's also good to be mindful of the fact that we're in what's called the desire realm.
That's right.
It's all coming
at us. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's interesting that this term today, because if you look at it, you go, like how each of your senses.
I still find this a challenging area because for me, I often see good and I'm enjoying my life.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
And I often have to actually look at what's happening to other people and look at the walls and then extrapolate to there that I wouldn't want to be doing that. That is terrible.
Yeah.
Part of samsara.
Yeah.
So I actually have to try and get motivation from
the other things. So I read a little bit about this the other day, Ian, where actually one of the lamas suggested that was the way to go. When he said, look, if you find this really hard to recognize your own suffering, because this is you know what you're doing here. You recognize shit, I want out. I have no control over the whole situation. Right? So he was saying, if you find it difficult to do with yourself, then look for somebody else so you can see it really obviously and then come back at yourself. And you go, okay, well, then I'm a human being just like them. these behaviors, I have them too. And you try and find out where you behave like that. Yeah, okay, yeah, I'm in. We're all in the same boat, sort of thing, you know. Yeah, it's amazing. This is like how we stay trapped because we mistake the causes of pain for the causes of happiness. I think it's in the Four Noble Truths. The first truth of suffering, where they say like one of the mistakes we make is the mistaking the impure for the pure. It's the same sort of thing with like here. And I was just, oh man, so I caught a little while ago that really came home to me. Like, oh my God, this is what I've been doing. Didn't even realize it. You know, so I'm not going to find my security, my safety, my happiness with this person. It's impossible. They can't provide it. And I've been looking at them like, maybe they can. Yeah. Oh, no, they can't. So, so when we want to move away from this uncontrollable recurring patterns of suffering. And there are basically like three types of the suffering. So our first is what they call the dukkha of misery, or the suffering of suffering. So this is this obvious pain. So in here you can sort of show like somebody just breaking their ankle. If you've done that, you know that hurts. And that's obvious to all of us, right? This is called suffering. Then the second one is where some sort of change takes place, where either the object that was once pleasurable now produces suffering.
Like feeling sick after the third packet of Tim Tams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Not speaking from personal experience.
Yeah, so our pleasure turns into to suffering, but our states of happiness flip. Yes, that's one of the major causes of it. The other thing is that we've forgotten is that the object is not pure. Right? So it's undergoing change itself. But the object itself is never stable. Right? Remember, it's impermanent, subject to change. And we'll come to this other one shortly, but this is fantastic. This book of change about the mind and this mistake. Well, I know I've of it again and again, and just recently I got caught again. Oh my God, that's what I'm doing. So these two are ones that we're all familiar with, and in the different religions, they can work against either of these two. But the third one is only a Buddhist presentation. It's called the dukkha of conditionality. It means that just by being a human being, we're going to suffer. There's this. The body is not under our control. The mind is not under our control. The external world is not under our control. It's all conditions, causes and conditions producing their effects. And we're in it, right? We've got, you know, we're persons, causes and conditions, and so forth.
This is a good going against saying there's such a thing as free will.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. Now, what's really interesting is if you go backwards from here, right? So if you take the dukkha of conditionality, right? So that's the nature of suffering. We, our five aggregates are in the nature of suffering. Right? So when it comes to the dukkha of change, all happiness is a subtle decrease of the suffering nature, and we feel a little better. Then it vanishes, and we go back to the natural thing again, right? Yeah, like that's quite shocking, but really good to sort of get your head around.
You could look at it as change, so we're at this level of suffering always, and yeah. The change is like, oh, but then it dips a little bit.
So yeah, that's right.
Relief, and then it comes back.
That's right. We feel better, isn't it?
That's a nicer way to look at it.
Yeah, so it's that way, and then you can also look at it like the one of the chocolate cake, right? It's actually happening. It feels good. We're, you know,
yeah.
Happy. And so we keep on engaging in the thing that makes us feel good.
Yeah.
And you know, that we don't feel good.
Well, standing up all the time until you're tired, and then you sit down.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. Mm-hmm. And then after 5 hours sitting down, oh man,
it's not necessarily nicer, it's just different.
Yeah, well, so I did a thing just like this the other day. So I'm sitting in this chair, doing something, like I'm like, oh man, like you know, geez, what have I done? So like, I can't sit down at the computer, so I raise the desk and stand up, you know. So I stood up for about 5 hours, right? Next day too, don't sit down, stand up, you know. So then this goes away, and now I've got really sore feet. It's like that. No, it doesn't, it's not stable, right?
Yeah,
so this is like the suffering of change or dukkha of change. Causes and conditions.
Causes
that's
and
right,
conditions
produce the effect.
The effect.
Yeah, that's right. They're all going to be, that's right, they're all going to be temporary. They're all going to change.
That are beyond our control.
Yeah, well, so, you know, they say, you know, one of the ways of describing this type of suffering is the contaminated end up, the contaminated aggregates appropriated by self-grasping. So you think of that, right? So the contaminated properties are the body and mind. And what we didn't go, that's me. Self-grasping, right? We identify with our body or our mind. Right? And now, so we've grabbed onto this thing just out of our control. And we go, that's me. And it's all suffering. Yeah, so this, like karma and the delusion, along with other factors as well, of course, have brought about this body and mind, right? And it's been appropriated by us to be mine.
Yeah.
This is my body, my mind, right? Now you're in. But that's also how you get out, right? Because if you stop grasping, it's not yours. You don't identify with it. There's your freedom. Appropriated. Yeah, so I think they call it the contaminated and appropriated aggregates. And you go, so who's what's appropriated them? You go, self-grasping. And, they go, and the self-grasping goes, then the name that calls it, me. Yeah, that's right. And if you don't do that.
And this ends into the 12 weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
This goes up into the 12 weeks.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, sort of. It's like, well, the good news and the bad news. You want the bad news? Give it to me. Good news? Oh, good. Not so bad.
You sort of have to really understand the bad news.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
To comprehend
the good news.
The good
news.
That's
right.
It's just going to be words and it won't
yeah,
make
yeah.
sense.
And that's what I presented, is like the first two truths first, mm-hmm. suffering and its origins, so you understand. And then the other side, a path and freedom. Yeah. Is your hand up for dollars?
No, sorry.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's okay. And so next, one of the questions, next one is this dukkha of change, right? So this is what we've got to work against, right? So it seems like the objects of our senses and the happiness that arises independence upon them are true sources of happiness, but they're not, as we have discovered all the way through our lives. It's just, you know, we just keep repeating because we don't have any other sort of option. It's like there's no way out until you come to these teachings. You know, oh, okay. So here's an example of the dukkha of change, the sufferings of change. We use this for the sort of hunger, right? So you start off, you are hungry. So you eat. And then there's relief. You know? And this is, you know, we feel good. This is what we call pleasure. I'm sorry?
What's wrong?
That's So the next thing, the relief pool, of course our hunger has decreased, don't we? We feel good, right? So we keep eating. And then it's like not so pleasant after all. And so new type of suffering kicks off. But like I said, it's this thing of I think it's so skillful to look at it like, no, it's in the nature of suffering. So what we call happiness is just a slight dip in the type of suffering we experiences. We call that happiness. That's what we call happiness. Right? And then because of change, it comes back up and then it goes neutral. But if it goes up too much, it's now suffering the pain again, right? Now we're in pain. Yeah, so it's so good.
That sounds like something I want to get out of.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not big.
I don't realize it.
No, it's not big on it. Actually, it's like a terrible seesaw that just goes up and down as long as it goes really down. And too high. It's, yeah. So, I mean, I think it's really interesting. What do you guys think? Because you think I should have to mention the real thing.
I asked if she, happiness of a high escape rather than suffering of the escape we're on to progress through the escapes.
Okay.
And I had it answered because it's like where we are now, we're in the suffering. We don't even know the happiness.
No,
it's like a listening situation. But why don't we focus on the happiness of enlightenment? It's like,
man.
But we don't know it. But we do know the suffering.
Mm. Yeah, that's the thing. I have to, like, that's what was great with the Buddhist teachers. Like, you started right where people were. So, you know, you start with suffering. Yeah. We all know that. But we don't know enough about it. Our knowledge of it's on just on the surface. And so he took it down a much deeper dive into it.
Someone who's new, how do you go deep into realizing suffering without it really? Really getting you,
yeah,
really
bobbing you out,
really down.
Yeah.
Like how can you monitor? Like, should you monitor that? I don't know.
Yeah, yeah,
I'm
yeah,
really
yeah.
feeling it.
Yeah, no, that's right.
The third and fourth noble truth as well.
Yeah.
Think about it.
Yeah, but it's like, oh well, is there? Is there a path? I mean, it seems
yeah.
pretty bad, right?
Yeah. I tell you that in the answers, I'll use this technique from the Diamond Cutter Sutra. It says, so take suffering. There is no suffering.
Okay.
It's merely called suffering. So you take off this thing called suffering. So I saw this in there, it wasn't said like this, but His Holiness says, he looked at the first noble truth of suffering. You know, it takes. You know, suffering, but actually there is no suffering. And you go, what the heck does that mean? You're telling me there's suffering and they tell me there's none. What do you mean? You know? Yeah, so he says, that's right. So he says, well, look, you know, when you first conceive of suffering, you're conceiving it through the lens of self-grasping.
Oh,
right?
Okay, yeah.
So that's suffering. So we start with that and he goes, there is none of that suffering. So that type of suffering doesn't actually exist. Right? That's why I'm saying there is no suffering. It's like that type of suffering does not exist. Come at the end, but the pain arising suffering does. That does exist. So when we have the dependent arising suffering, so what's going to make that a problem for you?
You don't know the causes of it.
No, if you cling to it again, you're right back at the beginning.
Cling to it.
Yeah, if you cling to dependent arising phenomena, which are empty of any intrinsic nature, right? But you cling, it's like they have an intrinsic nature. You're right back at the beginning again. That's why it's like a loop.
Whoa.
You have to break it. And the breaking comes after, in the second. So take suffering. The suffering here is suffering seen through the lens of self-grasping ignorance. Right? Suffering is a conventional truth. There is no suffering. That's the ultimate truth about suffering. Come out the end. It exists in the innate. Suffering exists in the innate. And that is subtle dependent arising. So have you ever had this experience where, like, you know, if you sit there just quietly without just, you know, no real thinking, no words coming, and then like talk to yourself or use words. It produces an effect, doesn't it?
Mm, yeah.
Yeah, right. Mere suffering. Use the words, you create suffering for yourself. Suffering is just mere language, words, mind. That's how it conventionally exists. The first one is conventional truth, last one is ultimate truth, next one is conventional existence. Not conventional truth, it was conventional truth or faulty. So another simple way, you know, we talk about karmic appearances, it's like the first one is suffering seen through that lens. The self-grasping lens, how things normally appear to us. It's that one, the conventional truth. That phenomena does not ultimately exist as it seems to. That's the second part. But it does exist.
Independence.
Yeah, independence. That's right, upon your mind, upon the names, the words you use, the cause and conditions, and the parts.
And an experiential thing is what you're saying there is like realizing that conventionally existing suffering has less sting in it.
Ah, for sure.
It's got less, when you're looking at self-grasping, it's got a lot of sting.
Ah, for sure. That, yeah, yeah. Yeah. The first one, you're really holding it as something real and solid, right? Yeah, and the last one's like, no, now you sort of release that solidity and grasping. This would exist, but like a mere name. Because like I say, in the middle one, you cannot find that suffering that you thought actually existed.
Yeah, okay.
Right? Does that mean suffering does not exist at all? Not at all. Suffering exists. Yeah, conventionally, as a dependent arising. And most subtle of all the dependent arisings depend upon name and conception, depend upon name and consciousness.
Mm.
Yeah, so that's where you get the freedom, right? Yeah. Otherwise, it was the same with me. When Rabin used to say, the fire devas are by nature suffering. And I just go, how do you get out? Right? Because I just hear it like that, go glunk. And I'm working out, but it can't be. And this is the way my mind was working with it, you know? You just hear the word suffering, it's real. But yeah, and when I grab it like that, you think of it as that, so what's that suffering depend upon? Well, it's not obvious to you when you just hear the word suffering. It's just a thing of itself, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But there's nothing like that. Okay, I'm going to move on, eh? Okay, so he says, look, led by this pure thought, this pure thought, the renunciative thought. Mindfulness, alertness, and great caution arise. The root of the teachings is keeping the pranimoksha vows. Bless me to accomplish this essential practice. So the root of the teaching is keeping the pranimoksha vows. So this pranimoksha vows are what they call vows for individual liberation. That's pranimoksha means a vow for individual liberation. So in other words, you're saying, I'm making a vow, I'm getting out. That's what I'm going to do. And so you've got different behaviors for ordained people and people like ourselves and so forth. And so, when we realize that it's our own undisciplined mind creating all the problems, we go, okay, so what am I going to do to stop that? You know, mindfulness. There's a lot of things I need to remember here, but I got to remember it. Like, the one where you go, the causes of my suffering are not being produced by anything external to me. They're conditions, but they're not the major causes back here. It's not they have, of course they have some bearing on it, aren't they? But they never ever think of them being the main causes. They're conditions. They meet our main cause, which is our self-grasping mind. They come together and you kick it off. Right? So we've got to remember, like, I'm a target for suffering, right? So it's going to happen, right? So don't go blaming other people and so forth. Take it on yourself. This is mindfulness, alertness to monitor the impulses. Because, somebody, we know all this, don't we? We walk out there, then somebody says something silly to us. The impulse is to strike back pretty much immediately. Huh? And that's because we still think, that hurt me. Right? So that's our impulse, to strike back at those who harm us. Like I said, the actual harm is it's back here. Right? So if you can, what's it called? Wheel of sharp weapons. So there's these great lines like strike it, kill it. What are you striking to kill? Ignorance. Ask Yamantaka. Strike it, trample on its head, and really sort of martial strong language. Yeah, so use mindfulness to remember what our goals are, alertness to monitor our impulses, and caution to avoid old ways of behavior. The old traps that we got led into. So you should say, what really helps you then is to actually have a sort of code of behavior. So you can go, okay, when these, I'll behave like this. And so they often, you know, you'll see the text, they talk about having the inner guards, the guards of mindfulness and introspection or vigilance, isn't it? It's like, okay, I need to remember stuff. I need to keep a good eye on what the heck's going on. So I do control my impulses. You know, don't have. To sort of finish up, so we end up again with this middle level of practitioner. So remember, their motivation here is to attain liberation, or state of peace. Also called a true cessation, and the example I give of the true cessation is nirvana, meaning there is an absence of afflictive emotions. You don't have any causes for them anymore. That's what we're trying to do here, the goal here. So, but even how do you get to that sort of motivation, even wishing for it? He says, well, study the first two truths, true dukkha and true origins, which is what you were saying before, Ben. You know? We've got to become really know deeply, what are we trying to get away from here? And it's, like you say, it's not just ordinary pain, because the sources of pain are much deeper than that, aren't they? And once we have this motivation, so we really want to, you know, it's natural for us now, if you imagine that, we naturally want to escape this way of being. What do we do then? This is now trained in these three higher trainings. The training in ethics, it's not just about living a good life here, but what's the ethics that get me out? How do I have to behave then? In terms of concentration, not just concentrating to develop good mental states and so forth, but how can I concentrate the mind so it's so strong that it won't allow any of the afflictive emotions to arise within it? And I meet that and you know, do with wisdom. And this is not just ordinary intelligence, it's the wisdom that goes, I need to put it into the self-grasping ignorance. So it's the wisdom realizing emptiness. We want to realize, yes, wisdom realizing emptiness or wisdom realizing selflessness. Either one will be fine here. They often say just the realizing selflessness of persons is the one.
Restrictive, absolutist,
yeah.
To me, and it's like concentration with it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know.
Really challenging,
right, yeah. So it says here, that, and this is quite right. It says here, that, and because we look at them as being restrictive,
like right? It's an imposition.
Yeah, yeah, it's imposing, isn't it? Yeah, but see, what's interesting here is the ethics is in a way self-imposed. And self-imposed because you know what causes suffering. So the ethics is one of restraint. It says, don't do it. Because if you do, you'll hurt yourself. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, passed it by law, didn't they? There was a lot of resistance to that, wasn't there? I remember when it came out. But then it's like, you know, you might look at it and go, geez, I've seen enough people fly through the windscreen and hurt themselves and all this. And, no, it actually helps me. I don't want to have that happen to me. I'm wearing a seatbelt. So it becomes a natural thing. It says here, ethical discipline is not a restriction, but a protective boundary that prevents the loss of energy. So the energy here that's talking about is when you put it into all the things that get you into trouble, right? That energy could be applied to your spiritual path, right? And if it's going out there to other things, you're not going to have much to apply for concentration, for instance. And your concentration will be very weak. But you're quite right, it's a good thing to bring up. Yeah, because and the lens, of course, is just cause and effect. Yeah, that's the big thing that you really look at. You go, okay, so we work out like what suffering is and what causes it. So we find it's basically our behavior and the way we think. So ethics is like a system of restraint, which is saying, look, you know what, you know what things do you. The ethical code is like, so don't do these things because they're going to produce these effects that you will experience and they're terrible for you. And if you want to get out, you have to stop doing these things. That's what it's sort of saying. Oh, they're all, that's the thing. It's all dependent. No, they're not. No, no, that's right. And that's why you see them change over the course. So that was all up to say. Oh, so, and then we have these three higher trainings. So again, they're ethics, concentration, and wisdom. They are called higher because they aim for the total removal of the mental poisons. Yeah, so in terms of these three higher trainings, the metaphor or illustration of them is, think of a lamp. So the higher training of ethics is the glass shade that blocks the wind. Focus is the steady flame, and insight is the light. So you don't have the frame of glass around it. You know, you can blow it out and you're not going to see things very clearly. So this is a way of thinking of it.
Protective.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Protective. Yeah, it's protective.
So sorry, can you just do that again? So ethics was the glass of the lamp.
Yeah.
Concentration is the flame.
Is the flame, the steady flow. Uh-huh. Yeah, is the, yeah.
And wisdom is the light that it produces.
Yeah. Okay, so final meditation. Maybe just settle down in your seat, drop your shoulders, elongate the spine. Just check to see that your head is sitting firmly upon the neck, that your eyes are either closed completely, a little open, or naturally open. Allow the body to breathe itself. And then create an altruistic intention to cultivate discipline so that you can benefit yourself and others. Have you ever wondered how you might find a lasting peace amidst the constant distractions of the world? So the three higher trainings form a bridge. Without them, energy leaks like a broken bucket. So what's the nature of ethical discipline in our modern and chaotic daily lives? So ethical discipline is a protective boundary that preserves mental energy for much higher spiritual purposes. Like a sturdy container, ethical discipline ensures our efforts do not waste away, unused or lost. But how do we move from simple behavioral restraint to a mind that is truly stable? Use our alertness and caution to avoid traps and create a calm and reflective inner space. Like a fence built by a gardener, restraint protects the fragile sprout of peace from negative habits. So what would be the result of refining our conduct and stabilizing concentration? What's the result of refining our conduct and stabilizing our concentration with care? Now, deep insight emerges. It uproots pain and reveals the path to liberation with absolute clarity. Imagine a lamp where discipline is the shade protecting the flame of focus from the winds of conceptuality. And perhaps tonight or tomorrow, try to notice how, if you can avoid one harsh comment, this will keep your mind from racing or scattering. So use mindfulness and carry this inner sentry wherever you go. That mindful choices become the sources of your freedom. Yeah, breathing in through the nostrils, exhale through the nose. So we know the practices for a person of middling capacity, and there's verses 5 and 6 we looked at these today. So we'll dedicate, we'll look at this for next week. So if you have a look at any material on my middle scope, just to refresh your mind, you can go up online, find it. We've got verses 7 to 9. So you can see we're entering the path of people of great scope. And yeah, talk about that next week. Please join me in dedicating. So due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the Supreme Guru, Bodhi Peter, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as thinking beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. A wish-granting, wish-fulfilling joy, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world. To the incomparably kind, tending that soul, I beseech, may all your whole wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And finally, is the prayer for Rinpoche's swift return, recognition and swift return. In holding and spreading the meaning's precious and complete teachings for explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience that is never discouraged. Incomparable, venerable Guru, to you I make this request.